Welcome once again to yet another Best Anchors Talks episode. This is a first-of-a-kind episode as it's a deep dive into a specific company, Palantir. Palantir is known today for its hot stock, but not many people understand what the company does or why it's accelerating its growth as it scales. This podcast aims to touch both sides of the story, the business and the valuation. To help me out, I was lucky enough to be joined by Arnie Tresi, an individual investor that has done deep research on Palantir and holds it as one of its main positions. We discussed the concept of asymmetry, what the company does, its competitive advantages and valuation, among other things. I hope you enjoy this episode, but before jumping directly into it, let's hear about today's sponsors. Today's sponsor is Public.com. Heads up, folks, interest rates are falling, but you can still lock in a 6% or higher yield with a bond account at Public.com. That's a pretty big deal, because when rates drop, so can the interest you earn on your investment. A bond account allows you to lock in a 6% or higher yield with a diversified portfolio of high yield and investment grade corporate bonds. So while other people are watching the returns shrink, you can sit back with regular interest payments. But you might want to act fast, because your yield is not locked in until you invest. The good news, it only takes a couple of minutes to sign up at public.com. Lock in a 6% or higher yield with a bond account. Only at public.com/bestanchor. So thank you, Arnie, for coming to the podcast. I think it's going to be a great conversation on a great company and also a very hot stock lately.
My pleasure to be here and actually to be here with a fellow European.
Yeah, it's actually, well, you're not the first European. I think you're the second, but it's mostly US focused, the podcast. So it's great. I think it's best if we start with an introduction of yourself and what you do and what you currently do. So whenever you want.
Well, I'm Arnie and I'm an individual investor. I've been obsessed with the idea of, I want to become an investor full-time already for more than 10 years. So when I was studying like a regular finance path, MSc Finance later, but I really try to focus my attention into, how I can develop my own way of thinking so that I can make decisions on my own. And that initially it was very standard, like studying finance, studying balance sheet companies. It's like, my approach is converging a lot to the value investing approach. But then I realized I wanted to develop a bit more as an investor. And when I tried to leave my analyst job, which I had for a couple of years, so I was working as a sell-side equity research analyst. I tried to build an investment holding, a tiny one, but I realized, I didn't have enough entrepreneurial skills to make it work. I was having an approach that was very value investing into excellent Italian companies. So in Italy, essentially, you have like two kinds of companies, or excellent industrial leaders or below average companies. And I was really focusing into these industrial excellence that shape the Italian industrial texture. But then with COVID, I approached more and more the tech side. I realized, wait a second, how come these companies like Apple, Google, Amazon, like the bigger they become, they seem to go against all rules that you learn in business. Typically, you learn, when the company becomes bigger, it becomes harder to stay competitive. It becomes harder and harder to keep growing. And then you see these big tech companies just crashing everything. So that's why I started to get more and more intrigued into the tech side. I studied more the platform business. I read multiple times 0 to 1 from Peter Thiel. And then a moment arrived when Palantir became listed in the stock market. Peter Thiel is actually the founder of Palantir. And I realized, wait a second. This could be potentially a big tech that is emerging. I want to know more. And honestly, I didn't realize that that would have been the start of obsession that brings me here like 4 years later.
So that's a great story. I think one of the reasons probably why these companies have defied all odds is because software has brought, let's say, winner-take-all dynamics, and maybe those were not so present in the past. I think that people struggle to see how a large company can keep growing and how being large is even part of their competitive advantage, which is what's happening with all the big tech. We're going to talk in this podcast about Palantir, but I want to know more about your portfolio and your investing approach. So I know that you tend to be fairly concentrated, but what positions have you had in your portfolio and what's your investing strategy?
Well, my investment strategy is in a keep evolution. As I mentioned previously, I was very concentrated, but into few Italian industrial companies. And now my approach is converging into trying to build a portfolio of, yes, concentrated companies, concentrated portfolio, but into disruptive tech companies that have dominance into a sector, that maybe even defined a sector. Right now, my portfolio is very simple. I was extremely concentrated into Palantir. I reached around 80% of a portfolio into that position for a simple reason. My investment approach is based on the concept of asymmetry. I do want to be very exposed in situations where I see there is an asymmetrical opportunity. So where there is a very strong disconnection between what is perceived to be the reality and what I understand is the reality backed by an obsessing study. And I would say 3 years of obsessing studies, now 4, have been enough for me to be, okay, I'm convinced on what I'm doing. And I see there is this huge discrepancy. And when I see such a situation where not only the narrative is bad, but I see the price doesn't reflect the true potential of the company, I like to be heavily invested. Now, the stock, since I started the position, is almost 7-8x. So even in the portfolio that I'm tracking, I'm up like 300% in a year or something, which is completely out of what I personally expected. And now I realized, okay, the conditions changed. Now I reduced the position a lot. I'm around like 1/3 into Palantir, and the rest is cash, waiting for the next big asymmetry to emerge. Meanwhile, I'm keep studying all the companies that I think trigger my interest, because the premise that is emerging in my investment approach is trying to flip what people typically do. I noticed that the hedge fund industry, but in general, what people do is, oh, there is this stock that is down, let me study it. And there is a big problem with that approach, I noticed. Also, like noticing how I made my crucial mistakes, like I went in Alibaba a couple of years ago, because, oh, the stock is down, I look the multiples, it seems cheap, let me start a position. And then I gradually added on that mistake. The big mistake is if you start from, oh, this is cheap, let me study it, you start to feed a confirmation bias that you are studying a company for a reason. And that reason is, oh, it is cheap, let me try to feed this confirmation with the information that I'm finding. So rather than trying to kick out the thesis, even if that is what you wish to do, you end up, at least what I was doing, was searching evidence that I'm not wrong, but feeding that thesis. What I learned to do is to flip it. What I mean with that is, let's say valuation don't matter for the first moment. If I wish to start a portfolio assuming that I could invest only in fair prices, what are the companies that I really want to have in my portfolio, which I think are the most dominant, are set to dominate for a long time, and where I'm obsessive enough so that I'm eager to learn more every day about these companies. And once this set is done, at least in my mind, then I try to think, okay, which of these companies actually have an appealing setting between the strength of the fundamentals and the price and the narrative that make me confident into getting a position. Let's call it like the degree of the asymmetry between the strength of the business and the perception. And once this set is done, let's adjust the portfolio according to this degree of asymmetry. And that's why with Palantir, as I realized I was facing probably the biggest asymmetry opportunity of my lifetime as an investor, I went so concentrated because on one side, I realized the opportunity was very big. But on the other side, I was very happy to be extremely committed into obsessively studying a company so deeply. Now, the situation has changed, as we will discuss better later in terms of valuation. So new considerations must be added. But that's more or less my framework. Mm-hmm. Now I'm heavily in cash because I'm studying new ideas and I let them emerge.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree here with your point of view regarding studying companies when they are expensive and not when they look cheap, right? Because a lot of people will say, okay, this is down 30%. Then they'll do a hugely biased research and then they'll probably end up making mistakes. Whereas I think the best way to do it is probably studying companies that might be expensive today, but surely you're going to get an opportunity in the next year. You don't have to basically act just when you finished an analysis and you can just wait for those companies to come down. So as you said, we're going to talk about valuation later. First, let's start with the business as such. I think Palantir's story is interesting. So why don't you talk a bit about how Palantir came to be and why, especially despite being, let's say, a relatively not old company, but Palantir was founded many years ago, but it has started scaling now. So maybe some thoughts about the story and why the story has changed so quickly.
Well, as you mentioned, the Palantir is a company that feels young, but it has already 20 years old. It was founded by Peter Thiel and a couple of other strong co-founders after 9/11, based on the idea that that should have not happened. And second, that could have been potentially prevented if the government had the right information in the right place so that they could spot that anomaly and act upon it. And Peter Thiel, who already founded PAL and sold it to eBay, got the simple intuition, but not that simple to put in practice, that, wait a second, like a terrorist is nothing else than anomaly into a data set. In the same way, we were fighting Russian hackers trying to essentially steal money from us with fraudulent tactics. And the only way we could deal with them was using algorithms to spot anomalies and then having a human operator to actually check that anomaly. Potentially, the government operators could have spotted some anomalies into the data sets that could have led to a high probability of a disaster happening. And that's how Palantir essentially started. From this intuition, from we work to help the government prevent terrorists. Then it was able to deploy software war context in Afghanistan. And since there, it has started to try to push into the government field. So enter the army, FBA, CIA, all the government agencies. Meanwhile, trying to develop also business side with the idea that the best defense contractors are not defense contractors only, but they need to have exposure to the commercial side so that they can feed the innovation loop that is now lacking in the defense sector because the incentives are literally against innovation. All the defense business right now works under the fixed contract, fixed cost plus contract, which is a way essentially to incentivize to work more rather than to innovate more, while the competitive space of the commercial world makes companies in a perspective where, okay, we need to really be the best, otherwise we don't survive. And there are a lot of learnings that can be transferred between the two sides. Mm-hmm. But it is a company that made a lot of controversies emerge since the beginning. They had delicate work with, they worked into places where, okay, but this software is actually used to kill people. They got the venture capital world was very against that. From one side, oh, this is not software. On the other side, how can you pretend to grow into an emerging successful story if from the premise you say, we don't work with Russia, we don't work with China. And China in particular was like the golden way for venture capitals at that time. And the controversies actually never stopped urging, because even before listing, Palantir was involved in the vaccine distribution. There were a lot of articles, oh, Palantir, the spy company that helps the government have an eye, know everything about the citizens. So there were a lot of stories that were not really backed by the reality, but that created this image of the company being this very bad, controversial company backed by Peter Thiel, who backed Trump. So the public perception was very bad. But now, with the emerging of AI and the company literally proving itself into the most difficult places, like AI into very regulated companies, into war now in Israel and in Ukraine, what was perceived, this software is actually powerful, this is used in war. Now the perception changed, because people realize, okay, what the company does primarily is defending the Western values and help government and companies to be ahead so that they can always stay competitive.
Mm-hmm. And you talked there about what the company does, and I want to go into that, because I think a lot of people know Palantir, have the idea that Palantir is a black box, right? They tell you what they do, but it's very tough to really understand what they do, at least in that black box, at least in simple terms. So how would you describe what Palantir does? And maybe sharing here one or two examples would be great, so that people who have no context understand.
Well, the biggest abstraction I arrived to describe Palantir as a company is software to build software, which seems very weird at first. But once we connect the dots, is easier to grasp. The intuition behind Palantir is that every problem is essentially a data problem. If you can see the information that you really need to draw a decision, you can actually make a better decision. But why companies, why government have trouble into executing the best decisions is because most of the time they don't really have the information in front of them in a clear way. So Palantir leverages two key points to build a platform that helps companies, governments draw decisions. On one side, it integrates with essentially every other software, every dataset, so that they can create what they call ontology. Ontology is this word that is just emerging now, but a concept that Palantir has been working now for many years, which is, rather than seeing part of your companies or just seeing data as a row and columns, the ontology encapsulates all the company, the data, and relationships between objects. So rather than seeing your company as row and columns, you see this company from above, seeing all the connections that make the company operate. Once you have this picture, which can be called the digital twin, plane of glass, you can have full control of your company. On one side, you can start optimizing for specific variables, because you understand how the flows move within the companies. And you can more easily build new software on top of that, which is the key reason why I said is software to build software. You make decisions first, you optimize stuff, but the long-term goal of Palantir is not being a data analytic platform or just a data engine that digests data from disparate sources. No, no, no. That is only the premise, so that companies can then build applications on their own. So that's why the data analytics platform label that many people just attach to it is completely wrong. Palantir needs to be thought in the same way we think of Windows for PCs. When you think of Windows, you don't think of a normal application. You think of a backbone application that helps you run and build new applications on top of it. Obviously, there are also some base applications that you can use, but that's not the goal, end goal of Microsoft. The goal, end goal of Microsoft is having that infrastructure so that even entire businesses can be built on top of that. And Palantir has been doing that already at a very, very mature stage with multiple big clients. But one in particular is interesting. Airbus started working with Palantir around 2015-16, where when they had an issue with the production of the A350, they needed to rush the production because the management issued a strong guidance. There were high expectations, but they realized that their data, like, they were not able to meet the deadlines. And they called Palantir to help them essentially solve this problem. Imagine this, the company is in difficulty, they have a business issue. And what companies typically do is, okay, let's call McKinsey and help us figure it out. But the problem with consultancy is that they tell you what to do, but not implementing that. While Palantir is positioning itself as, okay, you have a problem, we help you understand what is exactly the problem. We help you solve this problem by using our software. So initially, what Palantir did was helping Airbus with the support of its employees, forward deployment engineers, build a Foundry solution that was tailored for Airbus. We need to think of Foundry, which is the core product for enterprises, as a white operating system, which could be tailored for the specific needs of a company. So in the case of Airbus, they needed to increase the production speed by a factor of, well, a lot. And what they realized was that Airbus was struggling in the production because they had a problem with their data. Essentially, Airbus has a lot of subsidiaries around the world, one of the most complex supply chains, because what Airbus does is not producing everything, but they put together all the pieces. And even simple questions like, okay, what stage exactly are we with this plane? Is a simple question, but extremely, extremely difficult if your data sets don't talk with each other. In order to answer this question, you need to have all your data organized in a way where everything fits together and you can have that plane of glass that I was discussing before, which is called the ontology. Once you have that, answering that becomes easy. Once you can answer this question, then you start asking yourself, okay, where is the bottleneck that is making me slower? Okay, you can work on that now. You can start building new applications on top of this to help facilitate this production issue. So this is how Palantir helped Airbus in the initial stage and helped Airbus increase the production speed by around 30%. But the cool stuff is that it doesn't end here. Because by working with Airbus, then new patterns emerged and Airbus realized that they could themselves use this platform to give it to their clients. So when Airbus is now selling plane, they also sell with this plane software, which is called Skywise, which is the extrapolation of all the work that Palantir has done with Airbus, but made accessible also to the clients of Airbus. So Palantir helped Airbus create a vertical SaaS software that can have infinite number of users that Airbus is the owner of. So with this work, essentially Palantir helped Airbus becoming a software seller, because this Skywise is an integrated platform within what Airbus does. And what Skywise does is helping companies manage effectively the Airbus fleet of the clients. Imagine you are United Airlines, you are having your fleet of Airbus planes. What you really care is that these planes can work perfectly 100% of the time, ideally. And if there is some issue, like, okay, this door doesn't open, there is a valve that is not really working well, you need to know it almost immediately. And again, how do you know that? You need to have data that flows very effectively and maybe help gives you a signal, okay, you need to make a pre-scheduled my maintenance, preventive maintenance, so that rather than waiting for a disaster to happen, you work preventively on top of it, so that your core business, which is making people move from A to B with the plane, doesn't become hoping that your plane is fully operational. You know that. And the key interesting dynamic of this one is that with this kind of platform, Palantir helps Airbus becoming a vertical software seller intrinsically. And now they can even sell, like Airbus can sell software products to its clients, but it is a network. So right now, Airbus, like this platform, has more than 10,000 users and it collects more than 140 airlines. So imagine these 140 airlines are using this software, and if they realize, oh, this software is actually cool, we can learn more about Palantir. And then you have this dynamic where Airbus, which is a Palantir client, becomes essentially an ambassador for the overall platform. I chose this example in particular because since it is a client for almost 10 years, we can see the development of how a single client can potentially go with Palantir. And Airbus is estimated to be one of the top three clients with more than $100 million per year.
And here, one question. I think another, let's say one of the common criticisms for Palantir is that you talked there about an implementation phase, and you talked also about other consulting companies. One of the arguments by many people is that Palantir, more than software, is a consultant-based business. I imagine that they have a part of professional services. But what's the business model here? I mean, how do they generate revenue? I believe it's both from professional services and software. But once you've gone through that consultancy phase, let's say, or the implementation phase, how does Palantir scale the revenue? Airbus is a good example, but I imagine that not all customers are like Airbus, right? That they have a lot of customers and they can do a vertical platform.
Well, Palantir is a consultancy company. It's not software, has been like one of the key critics that the company and the stock faced. And I would say it was wrong, but not completely wrong. So it must be explained correctly. Palantir pre-AAP, which is the product that helped completely shape the direction of the company, was relatively very human intensive in the first parts, but for a simple reason. Companies called Palantir when they had a very strong issue for their business. And actually, that was the approach with which Palantir was dealing with customers. What is your biggest pain? We try to help you solve it with the use of our software, using these figures called forward deployment engineers, which on the surface, they look like consultants, but in reality, it is a very peculiar mix between a consulting figure and a software builder. And the initial phases of the company was trying to enter the company. We build you a pilot, and if it works, you spend on us like 5-7 million per year for this platform. And the more you use the platform as a typical software, the more users you get, the more use cases you need, the more you pay the Palantir to build that. Verisov is the company doesn't break down what is really financial, like sort of professional services and software, because from the eyes of the company, there is no distinction. Like what Palantir does is selling software, but the FDE component, so the non-scalable one, is what is needed to get the confidence of the clients. Typically, the software companies have a model where they have a very thin product. They push it with a lot of marketing, salespeople, and since it is relatively thin, easy to digest, clients buy it with a couple of clicks, and voila. The problem with that is if you could solve very difficult business issues with such a software, the companies would not have that pain. So in order to solve a pain, the Palantir philosophy is we want to have an expert into solving problems with our software that has already solved maybe potential use cases that are similar. And once you are in, you develop the platform that works for you at best. And then it becomes like a completely revenue from software. But notice a simple thing. This requires that in the initial stages, the business model is relatively slow because you need to have forward deployment engineers to actually work on use cases.
How much time does it take to implement, let's say, in a large company like Airbus?
Well, it was a matter of months in the initial stages. As we mentioned before AAP, so before last year, a pilot could take like 6-7 months just to have a pilot and then hope that the clients realize that this company, this software is valuable. But now, since the launch of AAP, which is the AI platform, Palantir changed their go-to-market because they were able to show the clients business value in a matter of days. So in 1-2 days of bootcamps, Palantir can essentially already show a pilot that makes clients, wow, like in so little time, you already show me that you can solve this issue. And this completely changes the adoption curve because clients can taste the product immediately. And this means they can also expand into much more use cases, much more licenses over time. So the process was extremely long in the initial phases. Now it is extremely fast, but it's becoming more and more click and go like. But there's a key thing that, okay, so this means that now also Palantir is replicable. And I would argue that here is exactly what the source of the moat is. In order to arrive to a point where you have almost standardized a lot of use cases and you can work on a platform in almost no time, it required 20 years of things that don't scale, as Paul Grauman said, to get to the point where Palantir is expert into solving use cases, while 99% of the software companies focus into we build the thinnest product that we can maximize sales on with a very strong sales force. While Palantir flipped the approach, they went on into, okay, what are the most difficult business problems that we can solve? And not only business, but also in the government space, like war. So what are the most complex problems we can solve with our problem with our software? Let's do a lot of that. And gradually we softwareize what we do so that everything we do becomes much more scalable. But now a company like Salesforce, Microsoft, that have been really focused into we sell software, can't really flip the business model into, okay, now we become an engineering first company. We focus into solving business problems and we let the product speak because all their infrastructure is built into we build the software, we push it with sales. Mm-hmm. You can't really build a software like Palantir unless you spent 20 years into solving use cases into all the industries. So Palantir right now, it is the only software companies that is both very horizontal. So Palantir can be used essentially for any vertical. Literally, there is where you can use a software to drive decisions, even building your vacation trip, you can deploy Palantir. So it's completely horizontal. But at the same time, since Palantir worked into softwarizing the most complex use cases, Palantir has built the knowledge to solve even the most specific use cases for any vertical. So previously, we were talking about Airbus helping the production of the A350. But imagine Palantir helping the vaccine distribution.
Let's hear again about today's sponsor, Public.com. Heads up, folks, interest rates are falling, but you can still lock in a 6% or higher yield with a diversified portfolio of high yield and investment grade corporate bonds on Public.com. You might want to act fast because your yield isn't locked in until the time of purchase. Lock in a 6% or higher yield with a bond account only at public.com/bestanchor.
Is completely different.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there's any viable competitors in the market, or maybe some companies that show promise that maybe will be competing with Palantir head to head in the future?
My position on the competitive space right now is everybody competes with Palantir, but nobody really competes with it. What I mean with that is, at an abstract level, Palantir competes for IT budgets. And how many companies there are to competing for IT budgets? You have both the big tech, and then you have more specific software companies all trying to capture that side. But apart for the business incentives that create companies more sales-driven rather than product-driven, but there are no real competitors right now for the most critical use cases. And we see that in real cases. Okay, war in Ukraine. What is the first company that went and actually helped Ukraine building a better intelligence so that soldiers could realize, okay, there is a tank there. I help feed this information almost real time with satellites. Same happened in Israel right now. In the vaccine distribution that I was mentioning previously, I remember I read an article about the UK. We need to deal with this crisis. And at the table, you had Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and little Palantir. So $1 trillion company. And at the time, Palantir was like a $30 billion company. So from these things, I realized, okay, when it really matters to work reliably and in relatively little time, Palantir is the only company that is succeeding into doing that. So all the big tech companies are potentially competitor, and they try to build what Palantir does. Literally yesterday or the day before, Microsoft changed the name of one of its products, AI Studio, into Microsoft AI Foundry. And Foundry is literally the key product Palantir has. So what we are seeing right now is companies are trying to converge to what Palantir is doing. But the reality is their focus is not into building that software infrastructure that Palantir has built. This more at an abstract level, but even more specifically with AI. Just to give a little sense, right now, all the companies are in AI are focused into our chip or into providing the cloud services. So you have the big tech, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, or, and in most cases, they also converge, the models. And okay, great. But how do you actually deliver big business value at scale, actually solving issues in whatever industry? You need what Palantir calls AI platform. So a software that is beneath the level of the models, so that companies can actually orchestrate models, an infinite number of models. Like, for instance, the CTO just shared a couple of weeks ago an interview where they said one of the biggest US insurance companies developed a storm of agents, 78 agents, that helped the underwriting insurance process from 4 weeks to 3 hours. And this, thanks to the power of the AI platform that is not a model, but it is the platform to help companies use these models while also ensuring that the model is effectively reliable because it doesn't hallucinate. Why it doesn't hallucinate? Because this AAP platform is strictly anchored to the ontology. The ontology is the source of truth that we were discussing before. And if the LLM operates within the ontology, there is always a source that the LLM can refer to so that when the answer is provided, that answer is reliable. And then you have also all that part into, okay, how do I orchestrate not one model, but many models in a reliable way where the models can access what they can see? And I don't give all the access of all the company to the model.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk. I think that was very clear. Let's talk a bit about numbers, right? So how much revenue does Palantir currently generate, more or less? How fast is it growing? How profitable is it? I think those three things are probably what any investor is interested in any company.
Well, Palantir is still relatively small. It has entered the S&P 500, now entering the Nasdaq, but it's fair to say that it's still relatively small. And it had a difficult period just after it went public, because back then it was growing very fast. But as the interest for software in general, interest rates rose, the growth rate declined below 20%. But now it is emerging as a phoenix on two key dimensions. On one side, thanks to the launch of AAP, so the product that I just described that help companies actually deliver value from models and the faster go-to-market with bootcamps, Palantir was able on one side to expand their revenues. Right now, they are at around $3 billion revenue, growing at 30%. But it is a 30% that is accelerating while also expanding the margin. And a key slide that made me realize, okay, there is something going on here that is really peculiar, is the fact that during COVID and the previous years, the life was easy for software companies. Money was essentially free. All the companies were spending a lot without really caring about, okay, I'm maximizing the value from the money I'm spending. And on the software side, companies were just focusing to growth. We don't really care of profitability because money is cheap, so we can always raise more capital if needed. And now with higher interest rates, the SaaS industry realized, okay, maybe we pushed too much on the growth side. Let's focus into profitability. But the software world works with a pretty simple rule, which is called the rule of 40, which is in order to evaluate companies, this is a shortcut, you can add the revenue growth to the free cash flow margin under the base assumption that you can boost your growth if you sacrifice margin. Essentially, if you spend more, you are going to grow more, and you need to find a good point of equilibrium for you. Obviously, there is a trade-off, and typically the bigger you become, the more you're focused into expanding the margins because you realize that your growth opportunities are relatively lower. And what we see from this slide is that the software world is now declining in terms of growth rate, and they just focus into expanding the free cash flow margin. The growth, which was around almost 30% back then, now is around 14%. And the free cash flow, which was almost zero, right now is 17%. It's called the rule of 40 because on average, the average company, when you sum the revenue growth and the free cash flow margin, goes around 40%. And Palantir is proving itself being a complete anomaly. I would call it even a black magic, because since the launch of AAP and thanks to this go-to-market motion, Palantir was able on one side to save a lot of cost because bootcamps are a 2-day event or 1 day or even half day event that makes clients realize, oh, this is exactly what you do. This is how you can help me. So it is faster and very cost effective. And on the other side, it is proving that its software actually works by having clients that keep expanding every year. And right now, Palantir went from being free cash flow negative when it went listed with an EBIT margin adjusted, so before stock-based compensation, which is a proxy for free cash flow of around 20%, to almost 40%, while also growing 30%. If you think of it from a ROIC perspective, it's like you are spending the same amount of dollars, but right now you are growing much more. So the marginal ROIC of this is almost infinite. And we should ask ourselves as investors how much this dynamic is worth. And that is why building a valuation framework on Palantir is so difficult, because analysts were completely not expecting this black magic to happen. Because from a regular standpoint, okay, you grow more, okay, you sacrifice much margin. Having a company that at the same time is able to expand margin while also accelerating is something that is hard to evaluate. But from an investor standpoint, that's probably the best thing that can ever happen. So as investors, we should ask ourselves, okay, what are the conditions for this to continue, even improve, or there are some factors that could go against us?
Mm-hmm. So you brought the topic up, not me. So let's talk about valuation. I mean, I completely agree with what you said, that Palantir has gone through an inflection point, right? They have improving profitability with accelerating growth. And obviously that was not baked into the stock price before. And that's pretty evident just based on what the stock has done. But now there are some concerns that the valuation may have overshot to the other side, right? While before it may be too low for the company's quality, now it may be, let's say, a tad too high. So I've built some numbers, right? So let's assume this exercise I did with when Palantir was at $58 per share. I think it's slightly higher today. At this price, there's an implied price to sales ratio of around 50 times plus, right? So Palantir is trading at more than 50 times sales. If we assume that the company grows at 30% over the next decade, which will end up the decade at almost $36.5 billion in revenue, which is quite substantial. And we assume that dilution slows down, because right now dilution is somewhat high. This would, let's say, an exit multiple I use 10 times sales. This would imply that your total return after this, let's say, I think they are fairly optimistic assumptions. This would mean that Palantir returns from here an 8% CAGR. And you're assuming 30% revenue CAGR through a decade, that it exits at 10 times sales. And just to see how, let's say, reasonable the 10 times sales exit multiple is, I did a filter, right, with looking for companies above $30 billion in sales that are trading currently in the US at more than 10 times sales multiple. So there are only 5 companies right now in the US that satisfy both conditions, right? NVIDIA, Microsoft, Lilly, Broadcom, and Visa. If we get the average free cash flow margins of these companies, they would be 37%, 42% if we exclude Lilly, which is an outlier to the downside. And these companies are growing in the double digits, or very close to double digits, right? So you're implying that at this valuation, to get an 8% return, Palantir will end up the next 10 years with 30 plus billion in revenue, and that it would potentially have higher than 40% free cash flow margins and will continue to grow in the double digits, right? To justify a 10 times sales multiple. Obviously, everything is fictional, right? Because we don't know the multiples or the interest rate regime that we'd have in 10 years. So what are your thoughts on valuations here? I mean, I understand Palantir might be a special company, but I don't know to one to what extent exactly that seems to an extent be priced into the current stock price.
Well, let me say that the position right now in terms of valuation is literally the opposite of what we were facing around 1 year ago. 1 year ago, the company was emerging as an excellent company, but the price was not really reflecting that. Right now, we are in the position where that is proved by your numbers. The company is emerging even more as an excellent company, but it seems that the price is already incorporating that. And I don't think it is fair to say it is not otherwise. Because 30% growth for 10 years is a very optimistic assumption for any company, literally for any company, even when they're smaller. And right now, Palantir is in the position where it is already more than $3 billion annualized revenue. But it is true. Like, if we look at the numbers, purely on the numbers based on what we know so far, how the numbers are emerging right now, the company is expensive or almost untouchable. So everything really relates into the confidence that those numbers are effectively true and what is the margin of improvement that they can achieve. When I was making valuation numbers at the bottom, the situation was, look, even if the company just grows 25%, it's already a bargain. Right now, we are in the position where in order to justify the current valuation, 30% growth may be not enough. So we should really think of many, many dimensions. What could be the fair multiple that is attached to that 10x exit on the sales? I ask you just to have your thought and I'll tell you mine.
So I think that as I said, to exit at a 10 times sales multiple, you need to be a very good company, not only a very good company, you need to have free cash flow margins that very few companies have currently in the 40%. And you'll probably, this also, I would also say that these companies also probably have lower SBC than Palantir currently, right? So the free cash flow margin is closer to reality, let's say, to real free cash flow. And at the same time, you need to continue growing, have prospects of growing, let's say, at a good pace, right? You cannot trade at, you will probably not trade at 10 times sales if your free cash flow margin is 20% and you're growing below double digits, right? So those are things I think are two reasonable assumptions to think that Palantir should have in year 10 to be able to trade at that multiple. I mean, only five companies in the US universe are trading at that multiple above $30 billion revenue, right? So it's definitely not an easy feat.
Okay, so I'm aligned with you, but I would point to the fact that if it is true that the free cash flow margin can stay relatively high in the 30-40%. In terms of free cash flow, you would get a 30x more or less free cash flow. And if the growth is really still around 30% while having that 30-40% free cash flow, 30x free cash flow would be very low, in my opinion. So I personally think that as Microsoft free cash flow, EV free cash flow converges more to the 40s, 50s. I tend to think that if Palantir is really successful into getting there, so keeping a very strong growth while also expanding the margins, the fair multiple would converge more to that. But again, it really, really depends into how we get that. Like the underlying assumption is the more the company grows, the harder it is to keep that growth rate. But in reality, how Palantir is proving right now is the dynamic where the more it grows, the more it can grow. Because mm-hmm. right now it is still very small. And my perception is it is in the really initial phase of becoming viral in the enterprise space. So
I would completely agree there. Like, I mean, I'm not saying here that it cannot happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm a bit skeptic on the fact that when you invest, right, and you discussed it at the beginning, you look for asymmetry, right? Mm-hmm. You look for good business or great businesses that are not priced as such, right? Mm-hmm. I think that when a great business starts to be priced as a great business, then your asymmetry decreases. Could that business blow past expectations and you still make a handsome return? 100%. But the probabilities here matter too, right? What is the probability that this will happen? Okay, it's a fair probability, but is the stock market giving you a price where you are compensated for taking that risk or that probability? Or is the stock market giving you a price where you are not entirely or fairly compensated for taking on this probability of being an exceptional company, which it can be, right? But if you think about probabilities, it's very tough to get to that point.
I don't disagree with you. Like, despite I'm extremely convinced on the strength of the company, stock-wise is already hard to justify. And we need to look at that from one angle, is exactly how you made us notice. Assuming a 30% CAGR, you already get to a market return. I did it with reversed DCF. Essentially, the stock price is already implying the company to keep growing at around 30% while also having a very sustained free cash flow margin above 30%. That is already a very, very, very strong assumption. But let's see what also analysts see, because in order to understand where exactly we are, we need to have a sense of what the price tells us, what analysts tell us, and what are the implied expectations analysts have. So what the price tells us is right now, Palantir is priced more or less. So this is a reverse DCF that I tried to make just to have a sense, okay, how optimistic are the assumptions? And assuming 10% discount rate and a 5% perpetuity growth rate, which by the way is very optimistic because typically you put just a 2-3%, but that implies a terminal EV sales of 8x, 21x free cash flow multiple. So more or less aligned to your numbers. We still get that in order to get price of 65, which is the current price, the company needs to grow around 30%, 40% free cash flow margin after tax, which is very, very high, with a 2% dilution, which could happen, or maybe not really, because meanwhile, the company needs to scale a bit. So theoretically, the stock-based compensation impact should decrease more and more. And the more it grows, the less the impact should be. But this is what the stock price implies. But then you look at the analyst, and the relationship between the stock, the company, and analyst have been very peculiar, because Palantir went on the DPO path rather than going on the IPO. So started already having analyst against the company. There are only two analysts that seem very bullish on the company, which are Dan Ives and Mariana from Bank of America. All the others in general are very skeptical, and every quarter right now they need to adjust their estimates to try to catch up to the story. I noticed this interesting dynamic. Like before Q3, analyst expectations were very low for 2025, 2026, expecting revenue growth of around 20%, while the business right now is growing 30%. And even if some analysts adjusted their estimates afterwards, the long-term growth rate expected by analysts are still slow. So there are different dynamics. On one side, the price is already implying a lot of growth,
mm-hmm.
above the range of 30%. Analysts right now are more expecting a growth around 20%. But who's invested heavily into the stock? And I'm personally, as I mentioned, I reduced because I didn't see the degree of symmetry, let's call it margin of safety for value investors, but at the end of the day, it's exactly the same thing. Right now, who stayed invested very heavily is essentially betting that the growth rate will be not 20%, will not be 30%, but the growth rate could exceed that 30%. So essentially, keep this path that has been in motion ready for many quarters to keep continuing while also maybe expanding the margins. Another question is, how reasonable is that to happen? On my side, I'm confident that the business can keep accelerating, but personally, I don't want to rely on that single outcome to happen so that I can survive as an investor. But at the same time, I realized that I've been surprised many, many times. Like, I didn't expect that in 1 year from now, the company would have developed into what I initially started Palantir think. I started thinking, so in 2020, what Palantir could become at scale at the most pristine level. Palantir is right now already what I thought it could have been in like 2026, 2027. So if you stayed invested, essentially you are betting that the AI wave is so strong and so long that the growth rate could keep accelerating from here, which is not something that I think it can't happen. I just think that is already an optimistic scenario where I don't want to bet completely aligned with that. But at the same time, I think it's at least on my side, not good to get out of the company. I just listened the other day an interview from Howard Marks saying, my job is not to predict, is just to adjust my aggressiveness and my defensiveness according to the situations. And I believe that's the approach I want to embrace. Right now, I don't feel this is a setting where I'm confident being more aggressive than I already am, because if I stay invested, I'm essentially betting on the future will keep improving from here, which I personally think will happen. But as an investor, I need to deal with the probabilities of that not to happen. And I don't have enough margin of safety right now to be overexposed.
That's exactly my point, actually. I mean, I'm not saying it cannot happen, right? And I think you're also claiming that it can happen. But at the same time, if that happens, then the return you are getting is not the same that the return you were getting 1 year or 2 years ago, right? Because nobody was expecting it to happen. Now people are mostly expecting it not to happen that growth will continue to accelerate, but that growth will be very high for a long time, right? So in that part, I completely agree with you. So thank you very much, Arnie, for coming. I think it was a great conversation. And I think we also touched on the hottest topic, right? Which is valuation right now for Palantir. So thank you very much for doing this.
My pleasure. And if I can just add one thing is, okay, let's make, like, what could make that happen? And I think the biggest hint is from the latest financial results where Palantir discloses some examples of clients that went in their scaling route. For instance, they said an industrial company started in 2022. In the first year of expansion, they went from essentially almost nothing to 5 million. The third year, 20 million. Another leading US hospital started in 2021. So essentially generated almost nothing there. After 1 year, 1.5 million annualized revenue. Third year, 4 million revenue. 15 million in the year fourth. So if you have a sense of, okay, how much this scales, and this happens to many clients, you see that the growth rate of each client is much more than 30%. And we know that the scale that a client could potentially achieve is absolutely massive, like Airbus and probably the Army, which are above $100 million per year. So essentially, the thesis is if we grow more than this 30% is because this dynamic keeps accelerating to the point where the growth rate exceeds 30%. Obviously, that is more like that is a bet, but we know that the odds are not too much in our favor as of today.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Arnie. for everything. And well, very quickly, where can people find you?
Well, I'm mainly active on X, but I have also a Substack called PalantirBullets.com, where I share weekly recaps on Palantir, and another Substack where I just share thoughts on companies that are not Palantir, so that I can express my view, my obsessions into other companies.
Perfect.